Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that I burned all of Ben's books so that he would be too incoherent to record this podcast.
I am too sad to record. Goodbye.
Oh, I'm not actually a dick, and Ben's books are right there.
As you can see.
As you can plainly see as I gesture.
Just like you could see Gabs doing dance karate moves while I said we love books.
Sometime we should post a video recording session.
We should. We could live stream it or something.
Yeah, so people can witness the joy.
Like, we could figure out the technology to live stream and something.
Like, anyone would watch it.
Well.
That, too. This week, we read Fledgling by Octavia Butler. She was a well-respected and award-winning member of the science fiction community, and odd for being a woman, and odd for, apparently, for being black.
Additionally, being a black woman.
Yeah. So, I guess when she went to conventions, people will be like, what?
Well, when you think of your standard science fiction fan, or for that matter, writer, what do you think of?
Ben.
Yeah, you think of a white dude with a fat white dude with a neck beard. Now, for the record, I try to keep my neck beard shaved off.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's nice and trimmed right now.
You do not
have one.
But, yes, a black woman is about as far as you can get from you. Neck-bearded white guy, as you can imagine. Even if we happen to share many of the same interests, which in this case probably is true.
Yeah, and like I said, she won a lot of awards for books that she wrote. People really liked her stuff, so...
Yes, and unfortunately she passed away tragically young in her early 50s a few years ago.
Yeah, we discovered... This was... Fledgling actually was the last book she wrote.
I know, I mean... Man, we should have gotten like 10 more books out of her.
Yeah. And if I'm correct, a couple more books starring these characters. So, genre?
Vampires.
We decided that's a genre now. Vampires.
I totally think it's a genre now. I mean, you could parse it more if you want. Like, there's the paranormal romance vampires. There's the whatever the hell the Twilight books are,
well,
vampires.
They're kind of paranormal romance.
Okay. Vampires. There's, like, the action-y urban vampires. Yeah. There's,
kind of like the historical,
yeah,
sort of vampire.
Yeah, more like the horror story,
yeah,
vampire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's this, which involves vampires, but not really in any of those ways.
Yeah, this is more like a, vampire commentary on group relationships and racism.
Something like that.
Ish.
Yeah, you know.
It's...
That very famous vampire subgenre.
Yeah. Group marriage vampire literature. Obviously, everyone has read a ton of it. This take on vampires is much different than you'll see just about anywhere else.
Which might be a good thing, because I don't know about the rest of yous, but I have a little bit of vampire fatigue myself.
Fatigue. Vampire fatigue.
Yeah, vampire fatigue, or fatigue for short. As everyone knows, it's an actual thing.
Yeah. Man, hey, have you read Twilight? Don't talk to me, I got fatigue.
Oh man, I'm totally putting that on Urban Dictionary after we finish recording. We got the fatigue.
Totally. Okay, so yeah, genres, vampires, and plot synopsis.
Not stupid vampires.
Go nicely hand. So I'm assuming a lot of people haven't read this book, just because I don't know how well-known Octavia Butler is outside the science fiction community, and I actually don't even know how well-known this particular book of hers is.
Yeah, I don't really know either. I just knew I wanted to read her, and I happened to pick this one up at a bookstore one day.
I actually read it for my advanced creative writing class in college. Our theme that semester was Chamber of Horrors, since we read a bunch of, like, horror-type novels looking at how they developed plot and stuff, because our teacher was a big proponent of write stories with plot, not that just sound literary. So I loved her.
Yeah.
Because whenever someone wrote that story, she was like, fucking stop it. And she liked my writing, so I liked her.
That's right.
So I just thought I'd give a very quick rundown of the book. So the main character is this little black vampire girl named Shori. And she wakes up at the beginning of the book, is an incredible amount of pain, has no idea who she is, where she is, anything about her. Kind of manages to heal by attacking live things and eating them. Wanders off and finds this guy named Wright, who takes her in after she bites him. And they kind of figure, based on the fact that she's biting him and enjoying his blood, but not killing him, she's probably some sort of vampire. So, after spending some time with Wright, she actually runs into more or less her father, who starts kind of telling her about herself, that they call themselves the Ina, and that her little commune where she was living was attacked during the day and everyone else was killed. But she still has no memory of this, because she was almost killed herself, so she's got some pretty bad amnesia. Then, a week later, her father's commune's destroyed, so she kind of takes off with a group of people searching for other friendly Ina that might take her in, and they run into the Gordons. There's another attack on their... commune's the word I keep coming up for it. Little neighborhood.
It's as good a word as any. It's almost like a little village. I mean, it's kind of a commune in some ways.
And it's on this attack that they're able to prevent and get some information from the killers, or from the would-be killers, that another group of vampires has been sending these humans out to attack Shori and the people around her. So they hold a vampire council of 13, which is their rule of law, and everything goes from there. So... that's my summary for you.
It's a good summary. I give it a 7.5 out of 10.
Oh, thanks.
A little wordy, but gets the job done. That was a good Gab's face for all of you who are experiencing this non-visual medium.
We're so good at this. We've been doing this for almost 2 years. We're so good at this.
We figured it out. So the setting of the book is the Pacific Northwest, because vampires love it there.
It's in the same universe as Twilight.
Yeah.
Although, the vampires in this book would, I think, win in a fight versus the Twilight vampires.
That seems to be the case with every vampire mythology that is not Twilight.
I don't know. I think the Twilight vampires could beat Dracula.
Well, that's fair.
Because he has a child brain.
That's right.
We should have like a vampire podcast episode where we just talk about vampire books that we've read.
Oh, we could totally do that. But we're going to read a couple more vampire
books.
Yeah,
I mean, we haven't read that many, but it just popped into
my head. That is plausible. And after the end, we'll be fatigued.
We'll be totally fatigued.
And the placement in time seems to be modern. The book was written in 2005. It feels like something in 2005.
Yeah, it definitely does.
So basically like now, but without Twitter.
Yeah, without smartphones.
Yeah.
All their cell phones are like flip phones. Like, oh, losers.
Losers.
Dumb flip phones.
Stupid vampires.
Y'all are dumb.
Yeah, time to get with the times. So the story is told first person, past tense, through the eyes of Shori,
mm-hmm.
Our vampagonist.
I don't know.
I can't come up with more, so I'm just going to vamp for time.
So, Shory.
Things are going.
I'm just laughing at stupid we are.
I know, things are going downhill.
So fast.
So fast.
Oh, it's not even like we read like a horrible book or something.
I know, it's a pretty good book.
I will blame it on the holidays. On the holidays. Ah, fuck that.
Because you're holidayed?
I was thinking like hollandaise sauce. So holiday, I don't know. So Shory is a. How old is she? 53? 53. 58? 53? 53. Okay. She's a 53-year-old, but she's physically about 12. And I guess part of the Ina. Lord Vampire, fuck me. Let me try this again. She's in the body of a 12-year-old, and the way the Ina work in this book is because they're actually born biologically, the female vampires get pregnant and have kids, which is not the case in, I don't know, if in any other vampire literature. They actually do age just really, really slowly. So at 53, she looks like she's about 12, and according to all the older Ina around her, she'll eventually look older, get taller, you know, be yeah. a little less creepy when she's having sex with people.
Right.
And then her one distinguishing characteristic is that she is black, which is incredibly unusual, and actually she's the only one of her kind who is black. She had a brother who was kind of light brown, but she's the only darker one.
Right. And that was actually bred into her intentionally so she could walk around during daylight.
Yeah, they managed to implant a black human woman's egg or something. Some of her genes or something into her birth mother and then successfully.
Yeah. Which becomes a source of conflict. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Let's maybe talk a little bit about who Shory is.
Yeah.
Instead of just what Shory is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she's a very direct character. She pretty much says what's on her mind. She's very curious, which mm-hmm. is a natural trait when you have no memory. Oh, by the way, she's amnesiac.
I mentioned that.
I guess you did. And
yeah, asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, but it seems like more than just the, okay, catch me up. It seems like she's the type who really has an interest in learning stuff, too.
Yeah, she's smart, so she's not just like, oh, how do I work? She'll ask insightful questions when someone gives her an explanation.
Yeah.
And, she's, concerned with, like, making sure that people aren't BSing her.
Right.
Like, when she meets them, she's immediately just says, okay, here's the deal. I have no memory, so I don't want to offend you. You're just gonna have to talk to me like we've never met before.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Instead of dancing around it the entire book, I mean, like, I feel bad and awkward. She never does that.
That's true. That's pretty unusual for a memory loss type of story.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have added that to the genre.
Memory loss story?
It's like an amnesia subgenre out yeah. there, right?
Yeah. It's like vampire. Overboard meets Dracula. Yeah.
Vampire amnesiac. If that's not a band yet, it needs to be. Vampire amnesiac.
Totally.
And she's a very rational, logical person as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially during the council meeting when she's asking good questions and seeing the flaws in arguments. And I mean, it sounds like the Silks are pretty much lying through their teeth the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Pretty transparently.
Yeah, they're not even trying.
Yeah, they seemed to be hoping that their argument that she wasn't really one of them would actually sway everyone.
Yeah, they were a respected and old family.
Yeah.
But then I thought it was funny during the judgment when most of the jurors or the counsel was just like, you were obviously lying the entire time. So, no. It's like, nice. Kind of like the Ina.
Yeah, I like that straightforwardness, for sure.
Because all of them are pretty much just like, alright.
Yeah, they don't spend a lot of time playing games, it seems. It's kind of the nature of what they are to some degree, and that they're, the way they bond, and the way that they're, either directly through venom, or in some cases just through pheromones and stuff, but the way they interact with each other is so guided by chemicals, like, you can't spend time screwing around.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else? What else do I want to say about Shuri? Oh, well, I guess, despite being a rational person, she is still at the same time an emotional person, but she doesn't really let that take control of her most of the time. Even though she's been in some situations where she, it would be forgivable if she did a couple times in this book.
Yeah, she definitely feels deeply and has moments where she doesn't even always realize it. One of the things I thought was kind of interesting was that the human beings that she's kind of, you know, taken in, at various times, they'll, like, touch her or hold her, and all of a sudden she'll be like, oh, wow, I feel way less shitty now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just need to, you know, touch people more.
Like, part of what you are, it's really helpful.
And it just, it kind of made me think of, you know, just people in general.
Mm-hmm.
When you're around people and, you know, close to people, that does help you a lot.
Right.
But yeah, she does a really good job of reining it in when she has to, so she doesn't, you know, fly off the handle and go crazy or anything. And actually, I just remembered one of the straightforward things she does that I thought was really interesting in the book was at the beginning when she's super injured, she kills and eats this human man who is part of this vampire community, and because she's so sick and injured, doesn't realize it's a person. She just thinks it's some kind of animal, and then later realizes that it was a person, and then finds out that it was, you know, a person that other people knew and loved. She feels really shitty about it. But instead of, like, hiding that fact the entire book and it becoming some kind of huge drama at the end that she lied to everyone, she just straight out just says it up front.
So now that you remark on it, it's kind of amazing that that didn't become a huge dramatic plot point.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, in any other book, the main character would sit on that and feel horrible about it for, like, 200 pages. And, like, at the council, one of the vampires would have been like, you killed an Ada guy! And right. Then she'd been like, oh, no!
I object. This is devastating to my case.
Yeah. And instead, she just, at the very beginning, was like, I want everyone to know that when I was really sick and injured, I killed an Ada man. I feel horrible about it, but I did it.
It's so remarkable that that doesn't become a huge plot point later on that I almost wonder if Octavia Butler set out intentionally to have something like that. That would be a huge plot point and make it not one. Like, maybe that was her big
idea. Trope twisting.
Yeah, maybe that was her big idea for this book. That's what it all grew out of.
Hey.
Stranger paths have been taken,
yeah,
to successful books. And then the other thing about Shuri is that she's pretty intensely ethical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really has genuine concern for how others are treated, whether they're Ina or human. And even when the Silks get punished, like, she feels bad for, well, the young ones at least, for being separated from their family. But I mean, I think a lot of characters and real people would not have the capacity for that.
Yeah, because she's, you know, oh, those guys were shitheads, but those other ones probably didn't have anything to do with it. That's not really fair that they're getting punished for it. The way she treats her humans,
mm-hmm,
her symbionts is what they call them in the book, at some point she realizes she shouldn't bite another vampire symbiont, and she tries to treat hers really well and not order them around or force them to do anything, let them make their own decisions, feel the way they want to feel. And someone makes an observation like, oh, well, you still have your ethics intact because you treat your people so well. She doesn't just go around indiscriminately being a jackass because she feels on some level that it's wrong.
Yeah, with not really any basis for it, which raises a question or two in my mind, actually. I guess it's one of those questions that comes up in another maybe like weird subgenre, but that idea of, you know, what makes a person that person, and is it something that is formed only by memories and experience, or is there something more inside than that, whether you want to call it subconscious or a soul or whatever it is. Off the top of my head, I can come up with a couple examples of stories that explore that same idea, at least to some degree. I'm not sure I've read one yet that didn't seem to imply there was something deeper than mere experience. Which is interesting to me, because I'm kind of inclined to disagree with that myself. Yeah. you know, sorry everybody, but I think if you erased my memory and started me fresh, that the me that would emerge out of that would have a pretty significant chance of being a different guy.
Yeah. Yeah, depending on who is bringing you back. But, I mean, that is kind of interesting, because, I mean, there are people in the world who have lost just about all of their memories, and then when they get them back, are different.
Yeah.
I remember reading a story about a woman who had full amnesia, and her family, her, like, husband and son and daughter, who I think were teenagers or adults or something, spent several years helping her relearn everything, teaching her everything back, and once she was fully capable and aware again, she actually left her family, because she was like, I really appreciate everything you've done for me, but because I have no memories of you, I feel no attachment toward you. And I was like, that'd be like fucking cold as shit to hear from your mom. Like, yeah. I don't love you, sorry.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. It's like, oh, if you know, remind me of, that David Levithan book we read every day.
Yeah.
When A was talking about, oh, you know, so-and-so's best friend is pissing me off, but I don't have all the past memories of the best friend to, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
That's kind of the same thing. If you lose all your memories, would I, like, think you were annoying and not want to talk to you anymore?
I don't know.
Because I don't remember growing up with you and everything else.
I mean, don't you think that a lot of the time anyway? Would it be that different?
And then my foolish sentiment keeps me coming back.
Like, if you were raised in a jovial, familial atmosphere, and you lost all your memories, and then you were nursed back to health by a bunch of humorless dicks.
Would you then be a humorless dick?
Perhaps you would be. anyway, moving on to some of the other characters. Starting with Wright.
He's her primary.
Yes, her first. Well, her first since, well, let's not get into that.
Yeah.
he finds her wandering around along the side of the road after recovering from her injuries. And they bond pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a big, burly, furry dude.
Yeah, he's a bear. He's like 23, 24.
Yeah.
Something like that. And his aunt and uncle, for some reason, expect him not to be having sex.
Well, you know.
That was just a really tiny plot point where he's like, well, they kicked me out. He's staying in this cabin behind his aunt and uncle's house. And he's like, they kicked me out because they heard sex noises. And I'm like, your aunt and uncle are prudes.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that seemed pretty plausible to me.
Come on! Who doesn't want to have sex with a giant hairy carpenter man?
That's right.
I don't really.
But... I mean, I don't really either, but...
But we're guessing you do, listener.
That's right.
Sure you did.
That's right. And so initially he kind of has this protector role for her, and then as the story progresses and they learn more about the Ina and about specifically her own capabilities as an individual, mm-hmm. kind of realizes that she's actually the strong protectory one.
Yeah, he doesn't need to take care of her.
And he struggles a little bit with that, and he's kind of looking for a way to stay useful. Mm-hmm. Other than just emotional support, which I think she would consider plenty useful, honestly. Yeah. And then, you know, that made me like him. That seemed like a really authentic struggle that people worth being close to frequently will try to be useful even when they don't have to be.
Yeah.
They'll try to do something, you know?
Well, and I think, especially as, like, a big... Like, we were saying, like, a big, burly, like, manly man type guy, to see that the person protecting you is, like, a tiny little, like, 12-year-old girl...
Right.
That would be kind of a struggle, too. Probably.
Yeah, that would be strange.
Kind of fight feelings of emasculation and stuff.
Sure. And maybe that's part of what's fueling his jealousy when Joel gets introduced to the group.
Yeah.
Because he struggles a lot with having another man being one of the symbiotes.
He kind of does the bro dude thing where he's like, well, it was okay when you had other women.
Yeah, totally.
But now that there's another guy, I'm not okay with it. Like, if some dude's like, well... If you cheat on me with a girl, it's just kind of hot. It doesn't really count. Like, okay.
Face palm.
Thank you. But other guy, that's just asshole.
That's right.
Okay.
Don't do that.
But the whole thing with the Ina is that they have multiple partners because they stay alive feeding a little bit off of a bunch of different people.
Right.
And toward the end, Shuri actually learns that it has to be people that you're close to, because part of the Ina's thing is they also need closeness and belonging and love. And if they don't have any symbionts or, you know, regular people they feed off of, and they just kind of wander around and aimlessly feed on people like most vampires do.
Right, and most other tales.
They weaken and die. So they actually can't do it if they want to live. And so it's not really like Wright doesn't fulfill her and she wants to include another person in a relationship. She has to. Otherwise, she's going to drink all of his blood and he's going to die.
Right. Yeah, if you're pulling some blood out of somebody on a regular basis, you have to space those visits apart a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, they're saying she needs probably 7 or so people on a regular rotation.
Yeah.
And make sure they, you know, eat heartily and right. Take care of themselves.
Which, I mean, it leads a little bit to maybe the implausibility of this particular scenario. Just, like, you'd think with that many people having to be attached to each Ina, even though they're a small community, especially compared to humanity at large. But it seems like it would be hard to have gone unnoticed.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Especially...
Because they're all rich and stuff.
And they live a long time and don't seem to age. Like, especially once you hit about the mid-20th century, it starts getting difficult to just pull up roots and disappear and pop up as a completely new person somewhere.
Although, she did mention that a bunch of them were planning on moving to Canada.
Correct.
She's like, oh, so-and-so council members from wherever... But they're going to move to Canada.
Like 3 of the families.
Yeah, I was like, everyone's moving to Canada.
It's the new Wild West, motherfucker.
Do Canadians just, like, not give a shit?
Maybe
like,
they don't. It's like, hey, who are the new guys? I don't know, a bunch of vampires and their human families. Okay.
Yeah, okay, sounds good.
All right.
Let's bring them waffles.
Let's bring them some Tim Hortons, eh?
That's exactly how Canadians work.
Every Canadian.
Canadians looked out, man, because their country stereotype is being the friendliest people in the world. That's true. That's the only Canadian. I was reading something. It's like, you know, what's his face? Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, had to step down because he was doing, like, cocaine and a whole bunch of horrible embezzlement shit. And he got kicked out of office, and everyone's like, yeah, whatever. Canadians are still the most friendly, ethical people in the world. They don't have corrupt politicians.
That's right.
It's like, what?
We're like Americans, but nice.
Except not fat and stupid and horrible at everything like Americans. That's what people think of Americans.
That's right. That's why we're moving to Canada next year.
Yep. It's time to officially announce that Novel Ideas will become an international podcast.
Novelideaspodcast.ca.
I'm going to go to grad school in Canada.
I'm going to go to McGill. It's the only Canadian university I can name. It's very sad.
I can't name any Canadian universities because I'm a horrible person.
All right. Ben 1, Gab 0.
I know more French than you do.
Well, all right. And so, moving on to other characters, I suppose.
So, that's about right. Nothing to do with Canada or anything.
Oh, boy.
Guys, just deal with it.
That's right.
So, Theodora is Shuri's other symbiont of note. She's older. I think she's in her 50s.
Yeah.
She's a librarian, and she's mostly just lonely.
Yeah.
Kind of looking for a connection and an adventure.
Yep.
Her husband passed away, like, 10 years before, or something like that.
Yeah, basically, we meet Theodora, find out she's lonely, her life is filled with hope, and then she dies.
Yeah. Because her whole thing is, she really, really wants to go with Shuri, and Shuri keeps saying, well, maybe you should wait until I have, you know, a home set up and it's safe. No, I really want to come. So she agrees to bring her along, and she's super excited, and she's learning all this new stuff, and she really seems like she's about to step into her own element, and yeah, and then she's murdered.
Yep, just so they could mess with Shuri during the council.
Yep.
The they in question being Catherine, what was
Dahlman.
It? Dahlman.
And the Silks.
Yeah. So we've mentioned the Silks a couple times. They are the perpetrators of the mass murder of both sides of Shuri's family. Mm-hmm. And the attempted mass murder of the Gordons.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get to her.
Yep. Because they are dirty, dirty racists.
Yep. And Catherine is one of their allies, and one of her symbionts murders Theodora.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at first Catherine seems like she's not. Like, she's speaking for the Silks, but Shuri mentions that she at least talks to her with a little bit of respect, and not like the Silks do, looking down their noses at her, like she's not even human. Well, she's not human, but not even a person.
Right.
Whereas Catherine seemed to treat her a little more fairly, but then it comes to light that she's just as racist.
Yep. And racist in, I mean, almost like a speciesist way.
Yeah, part of it's that she's black, but it's more because none of the other Ina are black, and
right,
in order to make Shuri black, she had to be partially human.
Right, and they really took issue with that.
Mm-hmm. That they were degrading the pure Ina race, basically.
Yep.
And so, it's not so much that she's black, but that in order to be black, she also had to be part human. But they definitely do throw the N-word out a couple times, so it is kind of a mix.
Yeah, it is kind of a mix. That read to me like that was more of them just looking for the most hateful thing they could say than that being a real component of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think for the purposes of driving home the theme to, especially to Americans, having Shuri be black in addition to being part human helps to drive that point home.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that's definitely the context in which we think of racism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very American racism thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think they also call her a mongrel, and I think that's more mm-hmm. what they're concerned about, is that... At several times during the trial, I say stuff like, oh, well, maybe you should have a human doctor look at you.
Right.
And are you sure you're even really Ina?
Yeah. Because Catherine... Are you sure you're bonded with those people?
Catherine having one of her symbionts kill Theodora was also partially to test Shuri, because they thought, oh, maybe she's not actually bonding to these people because she's not fully Ina, and this death, if it doesn't affect her that much, then we can prove that she's not... legitimate.
Right. Setting aside questions of, you just killed a person.
Yeah, which is fucked up.
Though it is kind of... It kind of seems that maybe that non-symbiont humans are not really people to...
Yeah.
The racist Ina, anyhow.
And even the symbionts can be resented to some degree, because it seems like the Silks don't necessarily like or treat theirs very well.
Yeah, despite being very closely bonded to them.
Yeah.
Like, that was... That's a very strange relationship that I'm sure it'd be interesting to see more of.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the chemical bonding that is involved in that relationship, I'm not sure it's possible for there to be, like, an awkward, standoffish...
yeah.
Resentful thing going on.
Yeah.
I don't know, but, I mean, even Milo Silk, who is the elder of that family, apparently he's been loved by many.
Yeah.
As it was put. Yeah,
Shuri does note that, even though he's hateful and twisted, she doesn't get it, but...
Like to mention just a couple other characters, I think.
Okay.
Preston, just to say, he's the sage. He's the wise...
Preston Gordon.
The wise old man.
And he wants to... He was originally looking to mate his sons with Shuri and her sisters. And is maybe still interested in that, even though her sisters are dead.
Yeah, because that trait that lets her be awake during the day would be a useful one to breed. Mm-hmm. Martin. Because we like him.
Yeah. He used to be a history teacher, and he kind of acts as the human teacher to Shuri. So he teaches her about the community, you know, how some of the stuff they use works. He teaches her how to use a cell phone at one point. And he's the one who... He talks to her a little bit about the council and breaks the news of Theodora's death, and... it's just, he's like a good, centered, calm person for her to talk to who's human, and kind of can bring in a new perspective for her.
Yeah, and he's, he's a pretty smart and wise person,
mm-hmm.
But he's willing to look at things from a non-idealized perspective. She mm-hmm. was asking him how he felt about his son becoming a symbiont, and he said that he admitted that he kind of hoped that he would set off and kind of do his own thing away mm-hmm. from that life.
Well, he even talked about how when he originally got chosen, he decided not
yeah.
to be a symbiont and stayed away for, like, almost an entire year before he couldn't help it and kind of showed up.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, and it raised, you know, kind of raised a question of how much choice do those people truly have.
Yeah, we were kind of wondering how consensual the relationships really are, because being there is something Wright also really struggles with. He wants to be with Shuri, and he feels like she's become his life, but at the same time that weirds him out, and he doesn't like that lack of control and decision. Like, he feels like he wants to be with her, but he also feels at the same time like he can't make the choice that he wants to be with her because he has to be. So he's really torn by that. And Martin brings it up and acknowledges it, that, you know, some people kind of resent it more than others, although mostly everyone comes to terms with it kind of because they can't help it.
Right, yeah. And it does seem to make them... I mean, it does feel good, apparently.
Yeah, it's a sexual process, for sure.
Physically and emotionally, mm-hmm. It feels good. And, I don't know, like, I was kind of... I guess I was kind of wondering if maybe this venom, whatever it is that it... in it that bonds them together so strongly, if maybe part of it is it just... like, in some way... cuts inhibitions or something, like, just to get past the layers of surface crap that usually take months to get past before you feel that close to someone.
Yeah.
Like some sort of reveal who you truly are drug or something. Yeah. You just both pop that drug right before your first date and know if you want to be together, like, by the end of it.
That would be weird.
Hey, I have a story idea all of a sudden.
Yeah. People are not typically built that way.
No.
Which could be another reason, you know, it's weirding them out.
Right.
It's been 3 days, and for some reason I feel like I want to always be with you, and that's weirding me out a
right.
lot.
Normally it'd take another 20, 30 years to make that decision.
Not quite. Or if you talk to a friend who says... so-and-so is my one true love. And you're like, you've been dating for a week. What is wrong with you? Like, society doesn't really accept that.
Right. I think we kind of want to, but I think most of us don't actually.
Yeah, the love at first sight stuff, most people are like, okay.
It's so romantic. Too bad it doesn't work that way.
So shut up.
That's right. But it does work that way, because for every million of us who think that, there's one couple where it worked that way.
Well, that's true. Just like high school sweethearts can have successful marriages, because one out of a million.
That's right, just because we all know one couple who managed it.
Yeah. Like, fucking stop that.
Knock it off.
Be like the rest of us and find... a significant other in adulthood. Jeez.
Be like the rest of us and die alone.
Be miserable and lonely.
Bitterly masturbating in a studio apartment.
Oh my. Oh my.
Oh my.
I'm not planning on doing that, but...
that's probably a good thing. So I think we're into the issues here.
Yeah, we've...
or at least the ones we haven't already touched on.
Touched on them quite a bit. Especially the racism aspect, which is one of the big ones.
Right.
For the feminism thing, just because I kind of have to bring it up, I don't really have too much to say. There's a fairly even mix. Ben said, you know, Shory does tend to turn to the men more to get advice, but that's kind of because all of these strong female characters she used to know are all dead. And she does run into a couple more as the book goes on, which is another reason I think that maybe there was a sequel intended, that some of these characters who show up later in the book were maybe intended to be... fleshed out more in a later book.
Gab's conspiracy theory.
But I think maybe just the most important is that the author is aware of gender dynamics and at times does mention how various, you know, genders of people and sexes of people play off of each other and the mix and all that stuff. So it's not necessarily that she tries really hard to make sure everything's equal. It's just that she notices it and points it out from time to time. So it's not, you know, completely oblivious or anything.
Right. And then we talked a bit about the, I guess, consent issue.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some other sexual issues in here as well.
Yeah, so...
starting with...
it's kind of our big one, which is... so Shory is in the body of a 11, 12-year-old black girl. She will supposedly age some more, but
right
now she's 11, 12 physically. She's 53 in terms of just straight up age. So she's 53 years old, but looks 12. And she has sex with Wright, who is like a 24-year-old man, who is an adult, hairy man.
Right.
Basically having sex with a prepubescent girl, even though she is 53. And part of it is because she bites him.
Yes, he does have the excuse of vampire venom causing weird mental voodoo.
Because we will say that before she bites him, he is not interested in having sex with her.
Right. Which is probably one of the reasons why he makes a good symbiont and not a weird, disgusting one. Yeah,
because he picks her up initially because he sees a little girl on the side of the road and he's like, holy shit, I need to take you to a hospital. And then after she bites him, he's like, whoa, that was weird. And then she bites him again. And then he's like, oh god, now I think I'm kind of attracted to you. He's freaked out by it.
And that was an issue initially because they were going, if anybody sees this, I'm going to jail forever.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't think that the book is entirely trying to explain away and just say, like, oh, whatever, like that. Because it does acknowledge, like, people will think it's creepy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, while I mentally knew this, I was still kind of creeped out when he's like, oh, like, I noticed you have no hair on your body. And then he, like, opens up her shirt and he's like, you have no boobs whatsoever. And then he's like, I'm gonna have sex with you. And I was like, what? It freaked me out really bad.
What is happening? A plus B seems to be equaling pedophile.
Yeah. And I was like, I know he wouldn't be doing that unless she was like a vampire who bit him. And she doesn't have a normal 12-year-old's body because, you know, she can heal from, like, bullet wounds in 2 or 3 days and stuff like that. So having sex with him doesn't destroy her.
Right.
Like, if you had sex with a normal 12-year-old, you would, like, kill her. Blah. And that's why when I was reading it, I was like, oh my god, my brain, like, I'm so squicked out.
Yeah.
Even though, like, it's kind of okay, and I don't know what's going on. And then I decided that this book could never be made into a movie, because if they showed that on screen, people would freak the fuck out.
Right. Which is why, if it was ever made into a movie, that Shory would be a young adult woman with no memory.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, she would not be looking like a 12-year-old.
No.
I was like, the interracial Cheerios commercial freaked people out, so having a 12-year-old black girl sex with a 24-year-old white man... The world would explode.
You know what? The world might not be wrong in this case. You know what, world? Sometimes you explode correctly.
So we asked Ben's roommate if about the situation. I said, well, there's a 53-year-old, but she was in the body of a 12-year-old.
He makes a face.
She's a vampire and she bites you.
He makes even more of a face.
You become sexually attracted to her.
The face is getting amazing.
Is that creepy?
Short pause. What about that isn't creepy?
You just kept piling on layers of creepy.
Like, okay, that's probably the right answer.
Yeah. So I'm kind of wondering on, like, how creepy Octavia Butler intended it to be. Is it supposed to be unsettling?
I mean, she was... just by being linked with science fiction, it makes me wonder if she was an anime fan. They're more prevalent in that community, at least, I think. But it's definitely a trope to have a young-looking girl who's actually, like, a demon or a goddess or an 800-year-old vampire or an alien or... just name it. It's a thing somewhere. Someone's made it.
Oh, anime.
And, like, those characters exist and frequently as part of kind of a pseudo harem, because God knows that's a trope, too, in that genre. And somehow you're supposed to feel okay about that because you have the excuse of, well, it's okay because they're actually 600 years old or from outer space or another dimension.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't know. I think if you have the hots for a 12-year-old looking girl, even if they're actually an 800-year-old fire demon or something, pretty sure you're still a pervert. I'm
pretty sure you're still disgusting.
I'm pretty certain you're going to jail.
It was like, Interview with a Vampire, which we have not read for the podcast, but one of the characters in that book gets turned into a vampire when she's, like, 7 or 8 or something, and eventually is, you know, a 60-year-old woman in the body of a little girl, and she's getting incredibly frustrated because she's become an asexual adult woman, but everyone's just like, oh, you're a little girl, let's buy you dolls and stuff. And she's like, I'm an adult!
There is a vampire murder spree happening soon.
Yeah. That's a pretty interesting way to... She treats it pretty interesting.
So. Yeah.
Anyway.
I guess if we do a vampire episode, I'll have to read that too.
Yeah, probably. Probably a good idea. And then I guess one of the last things I wanted to bring up for the sexual aspect is that straight and gay are not really a thing. Because Shory, you know, has Joel and Wright, who are two men, and then Theodora, Celia, and Brooke, who are all women. And all of them seem to kind of derive the same sort of pleasure out of her connection with them. And she runs into a lot of other people who, you know, that a male Ina will have several men and several women. So the Ina themselves just kind of care about if they like you and if you smell good.
Right.
And then the people are a little more conflicted, because they talk at a couple points about, like, well, you know, Wright says, well, I'm okay with this because at least I have a woman. I don't know how I'd feel about being with a man, like a male Ina, but
right.
Some people don't really care, and everything's much more fluid with them.
Right. And, I mean, I will add that with all of the touching and cuddling and the, I guess the blood sucking is not technically sexual, but it's pseudo-sexual for sure. Like, that would, if you were a straight-identified person and found yourself with an Ina of the same sex, that could be a little confusing initially, for
yeah.
sure. But it seems like anyone who actually forms the bond is pretty much over that.
Yeah. Well, like Joel's dad, Martin, his Ina is a guy.
Yeah.
But he was married to a human woman
right,
at the same
yeah.
time and, like, had kids, so... It's just, I think it's because the Ina aren't humans, the same rules don't apply.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I, reading it as a human, that's, I'm glad it was addressed, because it's one of the things I would have thought of, I think.
Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute.
It's like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder how some of the sexuality works out on those things, because mm-hmm. it's hard to picture that relationship being completely asexual.
It would have been kind of interesting to meet a gay or lesbian human.
Oh, like, yeah,
like a gay
as one
man
of the symbionts.
With a male Ina.
Right.
Yeah. I think that would be kind of interesting.
I agree.
Gosh, Octavia Butt.
Yeah, right.
How dare you?
Let me have my fail stamp.
Themes?
I would say belonging, acceptance, family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes up time and again. Shory's looking for a new family with her people, well, among the Ina and among the humans.
Right.
Trying to gain acceptance and love and relationships.
Yep.
And a lot of her symbionts are also looking for the same thing. That seems to be what the ones who kind of get to make the choice seems to be what draws them there, is they want that connection.
Yeah.
And they kind of refer, someone in the book, I don't remember who, says that the Ina are the closest thing they've ever seen to functioning group marriages.
Yeah.
And I'd say they definitely consider themselves little family units.
Yeah, well, you'd have to. I mean, they literally have to be in the same vicinity at all times.
Yeah.
So if you're not going to work that out as some sort of family arrangement, then how the hell would you do it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess since we like to throw in a non-academic literary theme, racism is bad.
God, guys. I know. I feel like we say that like every other week. Racism is bad.
Murder slaves is are bad.
Murder is bad. Get over it. Stop trying to be murderous, racist douchebag listeners.
That's right. It's a good thing you have a podcast to point you in the correct moral direction.
Luckily, you have us.
That's right. Champions of traditional morality.
Because your morality is probably not innate. And if you lost all your memories, you need us to guide you back to the light.
That's right.
God help you.
I know. What would someone be like if they lost all their memories and were re-educated purely by listening to episodes of this podcast?
Oh my God.
Well, they'd call people dicks a lot.
If you read all of the books that we talked about, you'd be pretty well read.
That's true. You'd have a reasonable base for your reading education.
But not sure about everything else.
Yeah.
You'd at least know that racism is bad. We would have at least taught you that
that's
much.
Right.
We're doing something. Okay. Strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Okay, yeah. It's written in a very direct and economical way. There is not a lot of pause for description, even in those couple of moments where maybe Shori is detailing her entire morning or something.
Yeah.
The characters are all pretty direct, too, just like the narration. Actually, they kind of go hand in hand. I haven't read any other Octavia Butler books.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to read Kindred, which is one of her, maybe her most famous book.
Yeah.
Her more famous books.
I would also like to read that one. For the same reason, it's the one of hers that I had really truly heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And also the, I guess the world building with the Ina, since I'm into that stuff, you know. But, I mean, that really is the really interesting part of the book, I think.
Yeah.
Because they are definitely vampires, or creatures that vampire legends come from, at least. And they're definitely not like vampires I've read or seen anywhere else.
Right, I mean, they, except for Shori, all have to, you know, be inside and asleep during the day, and they have to drink blood, which are kind of
the staples,
big vampire
yeah.
things, but they don't kill people by drinking blood, and the whole symbiont twist, and
right.
the need for a family and belonging thing, and
right.
all that is definitely not something I've seen in other vampire books. Usually they try to get around the problem of killing people by doing synthesized blood banks, or like animals. Those are kind of seem to be the acceptable substitutes for the vampires who don't want to kill people.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we just drink a bunch of synthetic blood, or we just go to the hospital and like drink blood bags or whatever they do.
Right.
So that you can have sexy cool vampires who don't have moral ambiguity.
Yeah, exactly. it's, well, yeah, I guess because of that, this in some ways is kind of the opposite of the standard vampire thing, because most, even if you're drinking blood bags or whatever, it's like, okay, these are clearly creatures that are not intended to be able to live in harmony with human beings,
uh-huh.
whereas the Ina have no choice but to live in harmony with human beings.
Yeah, they even mention, like, in their history that they were weaker. And they don't really know why, but they basically relied on people to keep them alive.
Right, yeah.
And whereas now they're, you know, stronger and more capable and do more, but, you know, back in the more superstitious, less technologically savvy days where they couldn't just hide out in, like, a bedroom all day, they'd probably be, like, a wandering tribe, and the people would, like, have to, you know, stick you in a cave covered in animal skins or whatever.
Right.
Not kill you in the middle of the day. So, it definitely, They still rely on humans to keep them alive, but historically, you know, humans are the reason that they still exist.
Yeah. So.
Yes. Weaknesses. I don't really think Ben necessarily had these same complaints as me. I thought, because the book has a lot of exposition, because Shory has no memory, she has to keep asking questions about everything. That's really interesting, because you get to learn a lot about the world. But at the same time, sometimes there's too much exposition for me. And I thought some of those conversations got a little long or dull occasionally. I was like, okay, more explanation. Like, let's make more stuff happen, please. There's a lot of talking, which makes sense with the way that Eno work. But occasionally it got a little old for me. And I thought occasionally that the straightforward narrative got kind of dull as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily going to try to defend those issues from an objective standpoint. I think that I just have a history of liking books where people talk too much. So when it happens, I don't think I even notice it.
Sure, you do love Jubal Harsha, so...
Yeah, just for example.
Okay. So questions. So I wanted to know, was this book intended to be the first in a series? Because there's a ton of exposition, I think it opens the door for maybe some more action and exploration. I think maybe the Silks aren't done with their grudge yet and could still try to maybe get around the law. And I think that there's more room to let Shory kind of grow into a adult Ina and maybe even remember some of her past. So I kind of thought, I even said to Ben, it's obviously intended to be the first in a series, and he was like, what?
Yeah, I did not think that was obvious.
Yeah, he thought it was a standalone, which made me start questioning my assumption that it was the first in a series.
So I actually have thought of a couple questions or remembered that I had them.
Okay.
At least. And one is, I guess, kind of an evolutionary sort of question, but it seems like the Ina should not have a large enough gene pool to have survived this long, quite frankly.
Uh-huh.
And long-lived and slow reproducing is usually a pretty terrible evolutionary formula. Yeah. Especially if they know from their history that they were extremely vulnerable and weak in the recent past. I'm kind of surprised any are still left. But that's kind of nitpicking because, you know, they're freaking vampires.
Yeah.
The other thing is just a comment, more than a question, but it's, so, you know, we think of old people as being cranky and conservative, and if, like, a 90-year-old person is considered irredeemably conservative in certain ways by many people, how conservative, irredeemably conservative, would a 500-year-old dude be? Oh, my God.
He's like, well, back when I was a child, during the role of Elizabeth I,
right,
we would hang people for that sort of crime.
Back when I was a teenager and Columbus was setting sail. Holy shit, you're old.
What are you talking about? That would be kind of interesting, like, if you're 300 years old and you still kind of have a 300-year-old morality, or if you update with the time.
You have to have some flexibility just to get by.
Right.
Well, boy, doesn't that just make you kind of want to talk to that person?
Yeah.
Like, Milo might be a dick, but he's got to be a awesome source of historical information.
I think they said one of his symbionts was a historian.
Yeah.
And that just talked to them, like, all the time.
If you met a 500-year-old Ina who lived in England for the first half of their life, like, wouldn't you be like, what is a Shakespearean accent actually like?
Yeah.
What did Londoners in 1600?
Recital play for me.
What did Londoners in 1600 actually sound like?
Was Shakespeare a real dude? Did you meet him?
Well, yeah, and even if they didn't have that information, just the day-to-day stuff would be...
Yeah, oh my God, it'd be
would
awesome.
Just be fascinating.
It would be awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Holy God. It'd be enough to make any historian just pee their
pants. Yeah, totally.
Like, I'm so excited about peeing!
A primary source!
Oh, yeah! Oh, yeah! Yeah.
Anyway, our verdict. I really enjoyed it. It's hard for me to expound on that because I just liked it.
I thought it was a refreshing take on a vampire story. It wasn't my favorite book in the world. I did enjoy reading it, but it wasn't, I think without the concept, I'm not sure if I would have liked it as much.
Fair enough. So what are you reading right now?
I'm reading No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy.
Does everybody die in this one?
So far, yes. I think that's how he writes books.
Fair enough.
If you've seen the movie No Country for Old Men, basically don't have to read the book is what I'm discovering. But I'm going to finish it anyway.
Fair enough. I'm still on War of Honor, though I think I'm now on the last 150 pages instead of the first 150 pages. Stupid 1,000-page books!
Dumb idiots.
I know. It's a problem when you get so deep into a series just to catch up on what everyone is doing and have a plot. You almost have to write a few yeah. hundred extra pages. I ran around page 700 and I was like, I still have a whole book left to read in this book. This is silly.
Yeah. I feel like that's when I was reading 1,000. You get like 500 pages in and you're like, holy shit, I just read two books.
I know.
And I still have two books worth of shit left to read. That's why like if I'm talking to you when I was reading Under the Dome, I'm like, oh, whatever, this just happened. Yeah. And that happened on page 300. There's still 700 pages of shit.
There's like, still like a Fountainhead plus The Awakening to go.
Ooh, start measuring page numbers in books.
That sounds fun. That would be fun. Especially for long books. You could split it up so many different ways.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you have any questions or comments or complaints... No complaints.
No, you can only praise us.
You can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And you can also find us on iTunes.
Yes, and if you do that, rate, review, comment...
Etc. And for next week, for the... holiday week? Yeah. we're doing Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wayne or Ween or Wine. I don't really know how to pronounce it. W-E-I-N.
Well, I don't want to contribute because you'll get mad at
me. Yeah, I will. So shut up. Just Codename Verity. That'll get you to where you want to go.
By Codename Elizabeth. Last name unknown. I think that's gonna do it for this time. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.